I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. The GDP, the gross domestic product, has been used since the 1930s to measure the health and the growth of the U.S. economy. Increasingly, economists are questioning the GDP as a reliable and useful yardstick. What about quality of life, social well-being, even happiness? The country is also grappling with a growing national debt, increasing rates of poverty, and a widening gap between the rich and the poor. This raises important questions about how to solve the country's fiscal and economic woes in a way that's fair and equitable, our topic for today's Radio Times. Joining us by telephone is Tamara Drought, and she's Vice President of Policy and Programs at Demos, where her research and her writing focuses on the growing economic insecurity, rising indebtedness, and declining opportunity in America. And Tamara, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And also with us is Ronald Sider, author of a new book called Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget. He's president and founder of Evangelicals for Social Action, a professor of theology, holistic ministry, and public policy at the Palmer Theological Seminary at Eastern University, just outside of Philadelphia in Wynwood. And Ron Sider, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Nice to have you both back, actually. And I don't want to get too wonky here, but I do want to begin with the GDP. And from your perspective, GDP, what's wrong with that as a measure of our economy?
Well, the GDP grows if you have a lot of crime and a lot of prosecution of that, because money spent in that. The GDP grows if mom and dad get a divorce and they live in two different homes. The GDP grows if you've got a lot of pollution. Obviously, the society's not better, so it's not a very effective measure of quality in the society.
Tamara, do you want to add to that?
Sure. You know, I mean, GDP basically measures the size of our economy and tells us what direction we're going in, whether the size of the economy is growing or it's contracting. But, you know, it doesn't tell us anything about how that growth is being distributed, whether that new income is leading to better quality of life measures, like Ronald said, whether poverty is going up or down. So it really was designed to measure economic activity, but over time it's become sort of a shorthand for social progress, which it is certainly not capable of measuring.
Well, I want to play a speech that goes back several decades. This is a Robert F. Kennedy in a speech about the GDP, criticizing the GDP, as both of you did, saying that it counts air pollution and cigarette advertising, ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. I'm quoting from RFK here. It counts the destruction of the redwood and the loss of our natural wonder in chaotic sprawl. This is also what he says about the GDP. Let's listen.
Yet the gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything in short, except that which makes life worthwhile. And it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans.
Tamara, I heard a knowing response from you.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a wonderful speech, and I think it feels like it was the last time we had a major sort of political figure talking about the real weaknesses and relying on GDP to think about how we're doing as a nation. It would be great to have leadership throughout the last three decades that continued to sort of make that call. But I do think we are beginning to see some progress. But it's just a beautiful speech, and it's hard to beat the words of RFK in terms of articulating the real weakness of GDP.
Well, I totally agree with that. Let me give Ron a chance to weigh in. Go ahead.
Well, the GDP goes up when the total volume in the economy grows up, and it doesn't matter at all in terms of GDP whether or not the growing income gets distributed across all of the groups or if it all goes to the rich. In the last couple decades, the rich have gotten most of the growing income. The GDP's gone up, but from 1993 to 2007, over 50% of all the growth in income went to the richest 1%. From 2002 to 2007, over 65% of all the growth in income went to the richest 1%. And in 2010, 93% of all the growth in income went to the richest 1%. Now, the GDP went up during that time, but the poor were at least standing still and in some cases losing ground, and the richest were getting enormously rich, and the GDP doesn't tell you anything about that.
And what? And you're obviously talking about this growing divide between the rich and the poor, and a struggling middle class in the middle there. What explains what you just described?
Well, the reason it's happened is complex. It's partly globalization in the economic world, but it's also tax policies. President Bush gave huge tax cuts. And about 65% of all those tax cuts went to the richest 20%. A variety of other changes have contributed to the same thing. We could change that. There are ways that, in fact, we could empower poorer people. But what's happened is that the richest have gained enormously and the poor are struggling. We've got 15% of all of our people below the poverty level, the richest nation in human history, highest poverty level in the world. That's simply outrageous.
And I do want to get back to that. Let me get back to you, Tamara. And this, frankly, worries me that when you have a country like the United States that is, as we described, the richest country in the world with so many people that are struggling at the bottom of the ladder, what do you think explains this growing disparity?
Well, I think, we often do talk about globalization and technological change, and it's certainly true that those two forces have put downward pressure on American workers, particularly workers without college degrees. However, at the same time, if you look across other advanced nations that also are dealing with the new challenges of a globalized economy and technological innovation, you simply haven't seen this level of inequality. And so I think what's important when we think about globalization and technological change is what we did in response to those trends or what we didn't do as a nation in response to those trends. And Ronald's exactly right. I mean, tax policy has been a major contributor to this, but there's been other sort of policies. If you think about the mindset that has guided our economic policymaking for the last several decades, it's been this notion that if we just relax the rules on corporations, if we create optimal conditions for wealth and income to be generated at the top and by our biggest businesses, it will trickle down. And so we've seen things like the minimum wage decline in its purchasing power because, under trickle-down economics, the minimum wage gets in the way of maximizing corporate profits. And it's been this consistent sort of ideology that it's going to trickle down. And, we've tried that great experiment, and it's really failed. When we look at what has happened to the bottom 60th, 80th percent of the income distribution, which have not made nearly the gains that the very, very wealthy have.
And just a reminder, the typical household, not individual, but household in this country, Tamara, makes about $50,000.
That's exactly right. And, getting back to GDP, it's really important to remember, that our wealth did increase as a nation. Between 1980 and today, it more than doubled. And the reason that's important is because, we're hearing a lot about the need for austerity and the fact that the United States is broke. And it's simply not true. We do have long-term deficit issues, but the idea that we do not have the resources here in this country to take care of our people and invest in our people is simply false. We've just made decisions about whether or not to make those investments. By and large, we've scaled back on a lot of public investment from state higher education to early childhood education. In the midst of record-breaking wealth creation.
Well, Ron, let me go back to you, because one of the things that you write in your book is that the country suffers from a deficit, poverty, and justice crisis, those three being connected.
Yeah, I think that's definitely right. I actually wanted to say one more thing reinforce what Tamara was saying. If you compare the period 1950 to 1980 with 1980 to 2010, the differences are striking. In both periods, the economy grew substantially, more actually in the earlier period. In the first period, the increase in income helped everybody, all of the five quintiles in the country. In fact, the poorest 20% benefited the most in terms of percentage. In the second period, almost all the wealth went to the top 20%, the increase in wealth. In the first period, we had major government expenditures. The minimum wage was higher. The upper tax rate was actually much, much higher.
Indeed,
in that early
closer
period.
Closer to 90%.
It was just a bit above 90% at one point under Eisenhower. And then in the second period, the upper tax rate, the highest income tax rate, was a lot less. The minimum wage didn't keep pace, as Tamara said, with the inflation rate. And a whole variety of things happened. And as a result, almost all the growth in income went to the richest. So it's demonstrable that you can have a growth in income and have it benefit everyone, but you have to have the right policies.
But just to underscore what you said about the 1950s and maybe even to the early 1960s is that you had the GI Bill from soldiers coming home from World War II. We created the highway system. These were government programs.
Right. And minimum wage was another part of it, expenditures for higher education, lots and lots of things. The right kind of government programs, not all government programs work, but the right kind really do empower people at the bottom.
Well, and just to get back to this deficit justice poverty crisis, about a minute or so before our first break here, but go ahead.
Well, we do have a deficit crisis. If we continue in terms of a current direction, for all but 6 years in the last 50, the federal government has spent more money than it took in. Now, we all know you can't do that indefinitely. And the national debt is getting to a point where it's dangerous. If we continue on our present trajectory by 2025, that's only 13 years away, we'll have to spend all the income that the federal government gets on Social Security, interest on the national debt, Medicaid, Medicare, and have to borrow all the rest. That's just crazy. We can't do that. So we have to deal with the debt. We have to deal with it in a way that doesn't send the economy back into recession.
Right.
But it's a real problem. We're borrowing on our grandchildren's credit cards, and that's not fair.
But we also can't balance the budget on the backs of the poor.
Absolutely. That's what my book's about. There's a just way
I read it.
To deal with this deficit crisis.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Ronald Sider, author of a new book called Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget. He's president and founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. Also joining us is Tamara Drought, vice president of policy and programs at Demos. She has been writing about and doing research on the growing economic insecurity in this country, rising indebtedness, declining opportunity in America. We're going to pick up on several things that our guest said after this short break. Also open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Westown School supports WHYY. Since 1799, Westown has invited students pre-K through grade 12 to pursue a life-size education, one that helps to prepare each student for what comes next, not only for college and career, but for a whole life. You can learn more by attending Westown's open house on Monday, April 23rd at 9 a.m. Details at westtown.edu. Westown School, a life-size education.
WHYY FM. You listen, you enjoy, and you know you're going to make a donation. So why not just do it now? And if you do, you can enjoy YStream, our regular WHYY FM programming delivered online without membership breaks. Sign up for YStream by April 22nd. For more information and to make your donation now, visit whyy.org/YStream.
Delaware Rep supports WHYY and presents Thornton Wilder's Pulitzer Prize-winning comedy, The Skin of Our Teeth, April 19th through May 5th. Called a marriage of Plato and Groucho Marx, the Antrobus family faces one disaster after another, from woolly mammoths to Atlantic City showgirls and end-of-the-world warfare, only to endure and thrive in this timeless tale of human inspiration and survival. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or rep.udel.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking about how to match our economic policies with our values and national priorities, talking with Tamara Drought, who joins us by telephone, and Ron Sider, who joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And we do have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Ron, let me just ask you a question, and then Tamara, I want to get you back in on the conversation. But just to underscore what you said before the break and also what's in your book, which is your thesis that it's immoral to ask our children and our grandchildren to pay off the debt that we are building up today.
I think that it's simply immoral to go on year after year after year spending money for seniors, for example, in a way that makes our grandchildren pay huge debts. That's not fair. But we have to make the changes in good ways. And it's simply wrong to slash programs to empower poor people. We can do it in different ways. The Republican proposal this year and last year was to increase the military budget, even though we currently spend as much on our military budget as all the other nations in the world combined. They want to increase that. They want to cut taxes on the richest. The current proposal this year is to cut taxes for millionaires, another $265,000 per person for millionaires. And then they want to slash programs for poor people. They want to cut food stamps by $133 billion over 10 years. 62% of all the 62% of the cuts are going to come from programs that empower poor people. That, it seems to me, is fundamentally immoral. So we've got to figure out a way to increase taxes, cut programs that don't work, cut the defense budget by $100 billion a year. That would be a just and fair way to, in fact, continuing to empower poor people and deal with a very real economic problem.
And I'd be curious, Tamara, how you see what Ron Sider just said.
Well, you know, I think he's exactly right that when we look at the Republican budget proposals, a couple of things stand out. And one is that we have to remember that the overriding driver of our long-term debt issue is both a decline in revenue, primarily caused by the Bush tax cuts, as well as increased expenditures on programs for older Americans due to the growth of the baby boom population as they start to retire. But when it comes to, you know, the cuts that they've proposed in domestic discretionary, the reality is that's not about deficit reduction. Per capita spending on domestic discretionary programs has actually fallen by about $195. $195 between 1980 and 2010. That's per capita. So the problem that we face, our financial fiscal imbalance, is not due to a growth in programs for the poor.
Well, and just picking up on that and going back to you, Ron, one of the things that you told me, and we were talking about this before going on the air, when you look at food aid, and there are many churches, many religious organizations that distribute food aid. They're nonprofits that do the same. What role does the government play?
Well, there are people out there, political people, that say that it's not the government's responsibility to care for the poor. Private people are supposed to do that. That's wrong biblically, and it's simply nonsense economically. Biblically, the Bible clearly says that the king is supposed to do justice and righteousness, and those words in the Hebrew mean doing economic empowering of the poor. There's a marvelous story in Nehemiah where the ruler discovers that the powerful people in that Jewish society have oppressed the poor in a time of famine, and they've actually taken into slavery people. And he calls an assembly, and he gives them a tongue lashing, and he says, give back their property immediately, and give their children back. He says, justice demands that sort of thing. The king is supposed to do that. Economically, it's silly. It's simply silly to say that private agencies can take over all that government is doing to empower poor people. Now, I want them to do more.
Yes.
Well, take food aid. The current situation, we have thousands and thousands of private agencies, synagogues and churches and so on, giving food aid every month. But of all the food aid that is given out every month, only 6% comes from those private agencies. 94% comes from government. Or take a different statistic. There are about 325,000 congregations in this country. If they were to take over the five basic federal anti-poverty programs, they would each have to add about $1.25 million to their budget every year. Now, there may be a congregation here and there that could do that, but the median budget is about $60,000. So it's just silly to say that private agencies can take over from government.
But there's such a, and I'll put this to you, Tamara, but they're not among everybody, but there is such an anti-government streak that the government is the problem. We hear this over and over again, and as Ron said, they're good programs and there are bad programs. But has this helped, do you think, kind of fuel our some of our economic problems?
You know, what really troubles me about this is it's this sort of growing almost meanness of spirit towards people who have fallen on bad times. And we hear this in terms of the language around these programs just make people dependent, which, you know, simply is not true. You know, there's been a lot of talk about the fact that we have more families relying on food stamps and that food stamps participation has grown significantly. And that's somehow painted as a bad thing, as opposed to we have been through a major economic shock. Most families are still struggling, even though the recession officially ended due to GDP growing in two consecutive quarters. And, you know, it's just a meanness of spirit that people who fall on hard times need a safety net. And we as a nation need to ensure that we have a strong safety net. And if anything, if you look at the safety net that other nations provide, whether through unemployment insurance or food aid or support for young families with children, we provide a much more threadbare safety net in this country. And the idea that we would further erode it is really scary and I think morally concerning.
Go ahead, Ron.
Tamara is exactly right. The food stamp program worked exactly as it was supposed to. In this huge recession, millions of people fell into poverty. Many, many more people needed it. So, in fact, the amount of food assistance through the food stamp program doubled in several years. But that's what was needed in that time. The Department of Agriculture actually did a study and discovered that, I think the figure was 60% of all the people who get food stamps are on it for only 8 months or less. They need it, they get it temporarily, and then they're gone. Now, that's not a program out of control, as Congressman Ryan said. That's a program working exactly as a good society would want it to work. When people are hungry and fall into poverty, we want to provide food assistance. We don't want it to become dependency, but we want them to be able to eat.
And for people living here in the Philadelphia area, it's about $35 a week that you get to pay for your food. Just to, again, underscore what you just said. Tamara, let me go back to you, and I'm not trying to be partisan here, but I'm also thinking about this, and I'm using quotation marks here, this war on women. I think it's kind of a faux war on women. But nonetheless, we heard a speech from Mitt Romney a couple of months ago talking about poor women and the dignity of work. But it does, I think, speak to this divide in this country about how we feel about poor people, in this case poor women, and how we feel about the rest of society.
Well, you know, it's really interesting to look back now and think about particularly the welfare reform law that was put in place in 1996, which was really aimed at adding a work requirement to welfare reform, which benefits single moms with kids. And, you know, the program seemed to be working well when the economy was booming, but when we look at it now, what we know is that there are a lot of families out there, a lot of children in poverty, in deep poverty, and an economy that can't create jobs, enough jobs for everyone who needs one right now. And so the idea that somehow the poor, and this is a long, you know, very long history around thinking that the poor lack some basic work ethic, and it's sort of driven the way we think about programs for the poor, and it certainly drove the conversation about welfare reform, which was that we had a whole bunch of poor women who didn't want to work. That was sort of the philosophy behind the welfare reform law. It was never truly accurate, just as in the food stamp program. Most people who rely on welfare are on it, and then they're off it. They turn to it when they're in need, and they leave when they can get by on their own. So, you know, it's just a repeat of the debates that we've seen around what the poor in this country need to get ahead, and the idea that somehow if we provide a leg up, we're going to create a culture of dependency, which I fundamentally don't believe.
Well, and Ron, just picking up on that, I'm thinking of let's say a single mom looking for work. Let's say she gets a job at $12 or $14 an hour. That's probably, you know, not a bad salary for someone trying to get into the workforce. But if she's got daycare to pay for, childcare to pay for, that's going to eat into her income.
Well, and to get a job at $12 or $14, she's very lucky. I
exactly.
mean, it's more likely to be minimum wage at $7.15 or $8 an hour, and that's really tough. Minimum wage doesn't even get you to the poverty level. Mm-hmm. It used to in the 60s. At minimum wage, you could get out of poverty, but you can't today. I'm sure we all agree that we don't want government policies that create dependency. Some have, and we don't want that. Mm-hmm. What we want is things like the earned income tax credit. Only if you work do you get that financial support or a Pell Grant. You go to college. If you don't study, you know, you're out in a semester or two. But if you do study, you're empowered for a lifetime. Those kinds of government supports for lower income people are exactly the sort of things that are the opposite of creating dependency.
Well, let me quickly reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. That's Ronald Sider, author of a new book called Fixing the Moral Deficit, A Balanced Way to Balance the Budget. He's president and founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. He's also a professor of theology, holistic ministry, and public policy at the Palmer Theological Seminary. That's at Eastern University, just outside of Philadelphia in Wynwood. Also with us is Tamara Drought, vice president of policy and programs at Demos. She's been writing about and doing research on things like economic insecurity, rising indebtedness, the declining opportunity in America. I wrote a book not so long ago called Strapped, Why America's 20s and 30-somethings Can't Get Ahead. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Jennifer from the University of Pennsylvania to join us on Radio Times. And Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm Master of Public Administration student at the Fells Institute of Government,
sure.
And I'm taking the fabulous policy development class with Dr. Pearson, and I'm actually in a group where we're studying poverty and coming up with policies to resolve some of the issues. One of the things we found was most Americans experience poverty short-term, but they go in and out of it a lot. And Mark Rank, who's a professor, I think, at Washington University, he predicts that more than half of all Americans will experience poverty for at least a year during their lifetimes, and that it's nearly 90% for African Americans. And just quickly, the other thing we've looked at is how inadequate the safety net is to cope with that temporary and transitional and persistent poverty.
Well, Jennifer, I appreciate the call to Radio Times really picking up on what both of our guests said. Ron, anything you want to add to that?
Just that we do need the safety net, and it needs to be designed in a way that it encourages responsibility and initiative and rewards work.
Well, and Tamara, she's also describing people, as you both have, of going in and out. And the idea that half of people in this country at some time in their life will be poor, does that fit your understanding?
Yeah, it does. I mean, there is a lot of volatility in this economy, and people do churn in and out. And, you know, one of the things we know that is a very good way of combating poverty is two things. Education, both higher education for folks who are graduating from high school, but then also starting much, much earlier in early childhood education and care. And that is one area where the United States is really quite behind in terms of other advanced nations, and it's also deeply tied up with the ability to go back to the last conversation we had for poor women to work their way out of poverty. Unfortunately, as states have had to cut their budgets, we've seen even longer waiting lists for subsidized child care spots for the poor, and that, quite frankly, makes it very difficult for a single parent to get a job and keep a job. And so the lack of sort of broad support, broad public support for child care is, you know, a real problem in this country, and it's also a real problem in not being able to improve and create a level playing field for every child born in this country.
But Ron, as you and Tamara are talking, I'm also thinking about there is a belief system in this country about, you know, the American dream, individual accomplishment, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, and there's certainly examples of that. But that's not true for some people's bootstraps are more helpful than others.
Well, the truth is that American society is less open to people moving up than virtually all European societies. We tend to think of ourselves as the great society of freedom and upward mobility, but in fact, in the last few decades, we've become less mobile. There's less opportunity for people to move up here than in Europe, and that's because of policies. I mean, things like quality education, things like Pell Grants for kids that go to college from poor families. I mean, all of those things really do enable upward mobility, but Pell Grants have not kept pace with the cost of higher education. I've got a wonderful story from my own church about a mother who came out of junior college and worked for a number of years and lost her job, had to go on welfare. She survived with welfare, and then she discovered she had cancer, and Medicaid helped her with that. She taught her kids that education was the way out. All three of her kids have graduated from high school. They all have full-time jobs. I know her daughter best. She dances wonderful liturgical dance at our church on occasion. And she went to Eastern Mennonite University. Impossible, except that she had Pell Grants. She had a federal work-study program. And she had federal loans. She's now a graduate, the first in her family. She intends to go on and do a graduate study in education, then come back and work at education in the inner city so other kids get the opportunity she had. But she couldn't have done it. Her mother couldn't have survived without good government programs.
Let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Ronald Sider and Tamara Drought and get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
The Japan-America Society of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY and announces Dine Out Japan now through Thursday, April 19th. As part of Philadelphia's Subaru Cherry Blossom Festival, participating restaurants are featuring menus with spring-worthy examples of Japanese cuisine, from sushi to tempura, soba to yakitori, and contemporary takes on classic Japanese flavors. For participating restaurants and more details, SubaruCherryBlossom.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Australia is pulling its troops out of Afghanistan earlier than planned. Should Americans do the same? Military analyst Bing West says no. Also, Ron Rash's dark fairy tale of World War I Appalachia. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Lincoln, introducing the new 2013 Lincoln MKS with available 16-speaker THX surround sound and independent suspension. More at Lincoln.com. Lincoln, now it gets interesting.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We began by asking about the GDP. Is it really a reliable and useful yardstick for the U.S. economy? Both of our guests and a number of economists have raised questions about the GDP. We're also talking about how the country is grappling with a growing national debt, increasing rates of poverty, and a widening gap between the rich and the poor. Our guests again are Ronald Sider and Tamara Drought. Let me get to, it looks like Larry from Reading to join our conversation. And Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Most of my friends would tell you that I am a really right-wing guy, and I am a Christian, by the way, but I wanted to give you something that happened to me. I was unemployed, so I went from 70K to whatever unemployment is. Had it not been for President Obama, I could not have afforded health insurance. It only cost me $160 a month, so it was subsidized, and I kept my health insurance. If it weren't for CHIP, my children wouldn't have had health insurance. So one thing, I would have lost everything. Now, I'm employed now, and things are good.
I'm glad.
But I am making a fraction of what I used to make. So I used to go into the emergency room and view the people in there contemptuously because, quote-unquote, they were using it as a free clinic. But what I realized, having that stat of unemployment, that had my children become ill and had those subsidies not been available to me, I would have done the same thing to either protect myself or my kids. So right now, if you want publicly funded health care, you're a socialist. If you want to reduce expenditures on poverty, you're a heartless Republican. But right now, the people that are writing the tax code are funding our elections. And until we can stop demagoguing either side of that issue, we're never going to get out of this. Never.
Well, Larry, I appreciate the call. It's a really fascinating call. I'm glad you're at least back on your feet to some degree. Let me give Tamara Drought a chance to weigh in. Tamara, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. One of the things that has happened, sadly, is that so many people have lost their jobs, from the working class up to the middle and even upper middle class. And many people who never thought they would have to rely on any type of public program, whether it's food stamps or public health care, have found themselves doing so. And I think it has really helped change, at least at the grassroots level, how people view these programs and how they view people who need these programs. But I think Larry's exactly right. You know, we have a hyper-partisan debate in Washington, D.C., and it's not helpful in moving the dialogue forward. The positions have been extreme, I think, particularly on the Republican side. I think that doesn't sort of excuse Democrats, but I think there has been a willingness by President Obama to compromise and negotiate, and not quite the same level of graciousness by the Republican leadership. So it's a problem. You know, the system is broken. We have not been able to reach the kind of historic bipartisan consensus that we have in previous times of real economic turmoil. And all of the programs, from the EITC to subsidies for higher education to raising taxes in times of need, have historically garnered bipartisan support. But we have not seen that today.
Go ahead, Ron.
Well, I think there's another angle that's important. I mean, thank you, Larry. That's a powerful story.
Yes.
And for Christians, surely one crucial question is, what does the Bible tell us about God's concern for the poor? And there are literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of verses in the Bible that say that God has a very special concern for the poor. And furthermore, it says that government, one of its responsibilities is to empower poor people. So it just leaves me totally astounded when people who are Christians say that it's okay for 45 million Americans, actually it's more than 45 million now, Americans to have no health insurance. Surely it's a biblical demand to say that as a good society, we will make sure that everybody has health insurance. And I'm glad, Larry, that not that you've experienced that pain, but that you've seen through it what justice means.
Larry, thanks for the call to Radio Times. This is a more secular question to you, Ron, but something you raised earlier, looking at where government spends a lot of its money. You talk about Medicare. You talk about the aging boomers. The idea, what, that boomers are going to have to do some soul searching about their reliance on things like Social Security, Medicare?
Yes, we clearly the biggest problems in the ongoing federal deficit, and I mean that is a problem. And the current proposals are not good enough. Mr. Ryan, in his 2013 budget, increases the federal debt by $3 trillion over the next 10 years, and President Obama increases it by $6.4 trillion. That's just not good enough. I mean, we've got to get over the next 4 or 5 years to more or less a balanced budget. But the way we do it is crucial. And two of the biggest areas are Social Security and even more, Medicaid, Medicare. Healthcare costs have got to come down, and it's very hard to do that. But it is possible. In fact, the Obama healthcare program, according to the Congressional Budget Office, would reduce healthcare costs in a substantial way. Not enough, but it's moving in the right direction. Seniors, in fact, I think both in Social Security and Medicare need to take a hard look. Mm-hmm. We currently spend about $4 for every senior, for every $1 we spend for young people between the ages of 1 and 18. That's not a fair balance. So we have to increase the age for Social Security a little bit. We have to say that seniors who are making other money substantially, you know, need to get less Social Security.
Means testing, I guess.
Means testing is part of it. We should do things with Medicare, but we shouldn't privatize it. You know, that's not the way to go. So complicated, but it's doable if we're willing to sit down.
Well, and not to add another potential challenge, but most of the money spent is in the last year of life.
That's right. About 27 to 30% of all the money spent on Medicare, and almost all Americans who are elderly are in Medicare, goes in that last 1 year.
Right.
And some of that's justified. I mean, you do an operation, you don't know if it's going to work or not, but some of it's not. We get lots of expenditures when people, doctors know, and they ought to be telling their patients that, in fact, they don't know
something
how to solve it. And so I've got a living will, and I think that's crucial. That's not death panels. That's, in fact, justice.
Tamara, your thoughts, and then we'll get back to our callers.
Well, you know, I worry, I think there's, when we think about the long-term debt, I think we have to sort of set aside Social Security, which is in a much different, it's funded differently, it's in relatively good fiscal shape, and I think there are better ways, better social justice ways to strengthen that program than means testing it or raising the retirement age. And one of the reasons why I worry about raising the retirement age is, we already have in this country a lot of workers who do backbreaking work, waitresses who are on their feet all day. The idea that they will be able to continue in those jobs through even an older age than 65, I think, is hard to see happening. The other is that we know that a lot of old workers lose their jobs, are unable to get reemployed. So moving the retirement age up, I think, is probably one of the least justice-oriented ways to strengthen the system. I think one of the best ways to strengthen Social Security is to raise the payroll tax threshold so that the payroll tax is one of the most regressive. Any earnings above 100, I think it's $105,000, are exempt from payroll taxes. If we raise that, we get a long way towards protecting the system for generations to come.
Let me get to, I know we could go back and forth, but let me get to Deanka from Glenside to join us. Deanka, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I was listening to your guests and their conversations about poverty, and something that they said struck me. I just completed my master's degree, and I was just wondering what their thoughts are. They said something about going into higher education as a way of kind of securing a successful future and kind of moving away from poverty. I was just wondering what conversation they would have in response to the fact that most students graduate with staggering amounts of student debt that's kind of impossible to pay off, and how that'll affect our economy in the future with younger generations coming into the world with that much debt on their backs just for higher education.
It's a good question. I'm curious, Deanka, how much debt do you have?
Well, I don't like to check anymore because it makes me upset.
Oh, dear.
But halfway through my master's program, so that would have been in 2010, I had at least $100,500.
Oh my goodness
is right. Well, Tamara,
Marty,
this is one of your issues, Tamara.
This is
go
right
ahead.
In my sweet spot.
It is indeed. Sadly,
it's very troublesome. And one of the things that really has changed in a generation is that essentially we have, particularly when it comes to public universities, 4-year and 2-year, which educate the majority of people going to college. 75% go to some type of public university or college. We have taken what was a public good, and that was supported through taxes by everybody, and really privatized it over the last three decades. And we've privatized it in a way that leaves young people paying for college by taking on way too much debt, leaves their parents often taking out loans, student loans, parent-student loans to help pay that, or taking out second mortgages on their homes or raiding their 401ks. And, you know, the main reason is that over time, the investment at the state level for higher education has fallen. We're at a 25-year low in terms of the amount that we are supporting higher education as a society. And that is the main driver of rising tuition costs. And as I think Ron said earlier, Pell Grants haven't been able to keep up with the rising cost of college. And the fix so far has been to saddle a whole generation with debt. And I think it's very worrisome. I think it causes a couple bad things to happen. One, it prevents a lot of really bright kids from enrolling in the best type of college for them, from finishing. The number one reason why people drop out is the financial barriers are just too much. And then when you get out of college, you know, it's going to be a long drag in terms of your ability to save up money for a down payment, in terms of your ability when you start having children to make ends meet as you're continuing to pay down those debt burdens. They don't disappear in 10 years, unfortunately. Most graduates take a lot longer to pay down their debts than 10 years. And if they go to master's school, they have even more debt, and it will take even longer. So it's just a horrible way for our country to price opportunity. And I call it the debt for diploma system. And it's one of the reasons why, if you look at the United States compared to other advanced nations, our older population is number one in the world. We have the highest educated proportion of old people in the world. If you look at 25 to 34-year-olds, we drop to number 14.
Oh, that's interesting. And I know you could go on, because you said, Tamara, this is your sweet spot, and I appreciate what you said and the way you said it, but let me give Ron a chance to weigh in as well.
Well, just in that context, it seems to me outrageous to talk about cutting Pell Grants from $5,500 to $3,000, which is what Congressman Ryan has proposed. That's the wrong way to go.
Well, and I mean, it's so short-sighted. I mean, that's I'm just, you know, scratching my head. It's so short-sighted. If we want to be, you know, a thriving economy, we need, as many have said, an educated workforce. And yet we have policies that make that harder and harder.
That's true as well. And it's unjust, unfair to the poor. I think about 50% of all the people who get Pell Grants come from families with incomes of $20,000 a year or less.
Uh-huh. Wow. Let me squeeze one more caller on, Mary from Quakertown. Mary, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering if Ron would comment on how the wave of illegal immigration has affected wages for our lowest to medium paying jobs. I mean, from what we're seeing, them come into good paying jobs like roofers and drywallers. I mean, I see it as a case of supply and demand. If the supply of labor is infinite, the wages are going to go down.
Well, Mary, let me take your comment. We have about a minute here, and I'll give Ron a chance to weigh in on that.
Well, I think that's a complex question.
It is.
I don't have all the details. I think there's certainly some competition that lowers wages, but it seems to me that's not the major issue with regard to immigration. It's a much broader justice issue. Biblical faith calls us to be concerned with the alien, and the discussion of immigration in this society is harsh and nasty, and it seems to me fundamentally immoral. So we certainly do need to deal with people who are here, but we also need to be concerned with the foreigner in our midst.
Tamara, about 30 seconds. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think it's hard to top what Ron just said. Yeah. I completely agree.
Well, on that note of agreement, and we figured there would probably be a lot of agreement, but we were interested in having both of you join us to give us your perspective on our economic policies, national priorities, values. Very quickly, Ron.
Yeah, if people want to hear more about what I'm talking about, go to www.evangelicalsforsocialaction. We've got an intergenerational justice declaration there they can sign. Thanks.
Thank you. And Ronald Sider, author of a new book called Fixing the Moral Deficit. And Tamara Drew, thank you for joining us as well.
Been a great conversation. Thank you so much, Marty.
You're very welcome. And she's Vice President of Policy and Programs at Demos, and Ron Sider, I should also add, as he said, founder of Evangelicals for Social Action. He's also a professor of theology, holistic ministry, and public policy at the Palmer Theological Seminary. That's at Eastern University in Wynwood, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of the show. We'll be right back. And do stay.
Joe Montana here. In my football days, I knew the importance of a strong defense. Now I'm sharing how you can help defend your health against pneumococcal pneumonia and invasive pneumococcal disease. Are you 50 or older like me? The CDC now recommends vaccination against pneumococcal disease. Even if you're healthy, your age puts you at increased risk and over 6 times greater risk of hospitalization with pneumococcal pneumonia than adults under 50. Schedule your appointment today at vaxassist.com.
Sponsored by Pfizer.